Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Congress acts to protect the nation's fisheries, but debate still rages between factory trawlers and small fishers. In Locking Horns, we hear a debate over the banning of jet skis and other personal watercraft. A new report says fiberglass insulation may be linked to lung cancer. And in our Earth calendar, we harvest corn in Minnesota. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. The United States Senate has passed a revision of the Magnuson Act, which establishes the rules under which we manage the fisheries for 200 miles off our coastlines. Suzanne Uticello is Vice President for Program at the Center for Marine Conservation. She describes what the law would do.
The Senate bill, like the House bill that was passed nearly a year ago, would give the councils, the fishery management councils, very strict limits in terms of stopping overfishing, some deadlines for rebuilding depleted stocks of fish in our American waters. It would create a mandate for all the fishery management plans to reduce wasteful bycatch, and it would protect essential fish habitat.
The House passed its own Magnuson Act last June. As this week's Environment Show closes, it remains uncertain whether leaders in both houses will agree on a single version which can be approved and forwarded to the president. Douglas Hopkins, senior attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund, explains the significance of this effort to reauthorize the Magnuson Act.
This is important symbolically. This is important substantively. And if it passes, it's going to make it much easier to rebuild overfished fisheries and prevent those that are teetering on the edge of becoming overfished from going over that edge. And symbolically, this marks the third phase in fisheries management over the last 20 years. The first phase was the passage of the Magnuson Act in 1976, which announced to the world that these U.S. fisheries were going to be Americanized. They were. The foreigners were pushed out of the fishery, and that began the second phase, which has been a disaster. It's resulted in overfishing of U.S. fishing, or overbuilding of U.S. fishing fleets, and the overfishing of many of our resources. I think you've seen the low water point in U.S. fisheries management, and this law marks the beginning of the rebuilding of U.S. fisheries and putting them back on a sustainable basis.
An issue when the bill was debated in the Senate was the question of regulating factory trawlers. Those are the big ships that catch fish and process them right on board. Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska and sponsor of the bill is concerned that the trawlers, mostly based in Seattle, Washington, will drive out of business the smaller fishermen from Alaska who he represents.
You know, in 1971, when I introduced the bill, there were no factory trawlers and no American fishermen really out there in the 200-mile limit. They were foreign factory trawlers in that area, and we knew they were ruining the reproductive capability of our fisheries. So we passed this bill and claimed federal authority, claimed authority to set up these councils, and they've worked. They brought about the Americanization of the 200-mile limit, but now we have a series of 60-plus factory trawlers that really are stationed primarily in Seattle that have now moved out and have contributed to the problem. They've created the new problem of waste and bycatch in the North Pacific.
The legislation allocates a percentage of the catch to the villages in Alaska, with the money going to community development organizations. A system of transferable harvest quotas, which the trawler operators wanted, was put on hold for 4 years, pending a National Science Foundation study. Jim Gilmore, Director of Legislative Affairs for the American Factory Trawlers Association, based in Seattle, says the trawlers have done a good job in preventing overfishing, all of them have federal observers on board when they go to sea. Nevertheless, he supports the part of the act that allows the Secretary of Commerce to step in to prevent overfishing if the fishery management councils do not. Generally, however, he says the act is unfair to the Washington-based trawlers.
Overall, in the North Pacific, we're very disappointed. We believe that the act has Alaskanized the federal fisheries at the expense of Washington State's fishing fleet. But there are these rudimentary conservation provisions that are needed on the East Coast, and that has helped push this bill through and propelled Alaska's parochial interests along with that at our expense.
Senator Stevens says he's not sure the controls on the trawlers will be tough enough. He feels strongly that smaller boats and processing onshore is better for conservation.
The smaller vessels that are more discreet and literally handle best to handle fish almost by individual fish have the chance to preserve the fishery. And it's not, I don't want to concentrate just on the North Pacific, which is my area, but take New England. The lobster fishery is being harmed by trawlers that come in and scoop up lobsters, incidentally, to catching other fish. The Atlantic mackerel fishery, the shrimp fishery. All over around our shore, we have fisheries that are in trouble because these factory trawlers are targeting one species, but they catch another. That's called bycatch. When they target the species they want, but find that it's not the right size, and they throw them overboard, that's literally waste.
Ted Stevens is the senior United States senator from Alaska, and along with Senator Kerry from Massachusetts, is the sponsor of the Magnuson Act revisions in the Senate. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. While Congress, considering the Magnuson Act, debates control over fishing trawlers operating out of Seattle, local residents have banned much smaller vessels which they maintain disrupt the ecosystem. The San Juan Islands, just north of Seattle, Washington, are home to a diverse population of marine life. An area of breathtaking natural beauty, currently it is in the process of being designated a marine sanctuary by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Birds, fish, and marine mammals, including one of the largest pods of killer whales, are found there. Although it's often foggy and cold, the area has seen a rise in human activities, especially in the use of personal watercraft, or PWCs. Jet skis are the most well-known variety of PWCs. In response, the county, which includes San Juan Islands, banned PWCs. It's now being sued by several businesses and individuals who seek to overturn the ban. Joining us are Rhea Miller, a San Juan County Commissioner, and Chris Hodgkins, an attorney for a local touring company which uses PWCs, a local resident, and a local port district. They lock horns over the question, should the ban on personal watercraft in the waters around the San Juan Islands and Washington State be maintained? Rhea Miller.
Yes, you know, the citizens overwhelmingly brought this issue to restrict personal watercraft in the county because they were very concerned, and so the county commissioners, we had the obligation to look at the issue. We decided it was a prudent measure to restrict personal watercraft as far as a ban, with a couple of small exceptions. Part of the reason we decided to do that is this whole area has been nominated as a marine sanctuary, which means that it has even national recognition for being a place of peace and tranquility. And so we had very much a concern about the environment here. We have seals, orca whales, and concerned about the behavior of personal watercraft in an area that has sensitive marine wildlife. We were concerned about safety issues.
And mostly we're concerned that the very lifeblood of San Juan County is its peace and tranquility. People come from all over the world, literally, to enjoy this area.
Chris Hodgkin in reply.
The commissioners, in fact, had drafted ban ordinances. Two of them had already drafted ban ordinances before they held a single second of public hearing. This is really a very visceral, and that's a word that one of the county officials used, a visceral response to something that they don't like. There is not a single documented evidence of any harm to any marine life in San Juan County. There's not a single safety issue in San Juan County. The sheriff, in fact, testified under oath that other kinds of craft were a larger safety problem than personal watercraft were. It really is purely an emotional response, and we feel that people's rights should not be taken away because of emotional or visceral responses. There is no factual basis for this at this time.
Rhea Miller in reply.
Well, you know, we're not going to wait in San Juan County until someone dies or some terrible incident happens to deal with the issue of personal watercraft. We're looking at testimony from all over the country about the huge accident rise with personal watercraft. We've seen that it's been banned in the Monterey Marine Sanctuary, in Glacier National Park, and other areas of environmental significance. They have been severely restricted. We had testimony from biologists.
Chris Hodgkin, the last word.
They have not been banned in Monterey. They have been restricted to certain areas, and the industry has suggested that such a policy be followed in San Juan County. The commissioners have simply no interest in even talking about reasonable use.
We set this ban as only 2 years, and
Thank
we
you.
Are definitely interested in pursuing what is going to happen in the future, whether we'll open it up.
Thank you both. Our time is up. We've been joined by Rhea Miller, San Juan County Commissioner for the San Juan Islands in the state of Washington, and Chris Hodgkins, attorney for a local company that runs tours of personal watercraft, a local resident, and a local port district. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berling. Still ahead, a new study says fiberglass insulation may be linked to lung cancer. We hear a portrait of a farm in Ohio. And in our Earth calendar, we harvest corn in Minnesota. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. As winter looms ahead and Americans turn their thoughts to shoveling snow and heating bills, a new report takes aim at one of the easiest ways to help the environment and your pocketbook. Fiberglass insulation, the most popular insulating material, is cited in a new study as a significant indoor pollutant that may lead to health problems. At issue are the tiny glass fragments which make up fiberglass. Some research suggests that when inhaled, the glass can become embedded in the lungs and esophagus and may lead to cancer. But officials warn that the evidence is not conclusive and all agree that more research is needed. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
The good news is that if your home is one of the 85% of homes in the U.S. with fiberglass insulation, you almost certainly don't need to remove it. But the Natural Resources Defense Council says if you're adding new insulation, you may want to consider alternatives to fiberglass, or at the very least, take precautions.
We found that fiberglass insulation, the product that is most widely used in home insulation, also has the most health risks associated with it. Two of the alternative products that we looked at, cellulose insulation and cotton insulation, do not have nearly as many documented health threats associated with them, appear to perform just as well or better in some cases, have higher recycled content, require less energy to be produced, and therefore have overall very desirable environmental and health benefits.
Anjanette DiCarlo is a research associate at NRDC and the author of a study on insulation. The evidence linking fiberglass to health problems is not conclusive. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, a sister group of the World Health Organization, has listed fiberglass as a potential carcinogen, and a U.S. governmental organization, the National Toxicology Program, has listed fiberglass as a substance which may be, quote, reasonably anticipated to be a carcinogen. Catherine Imus is with the North American Insulation Manufacturers Association, which represents the fiberglass industry. She says if the recommended safeguards are used, fiberglass is safe.
Fiberglass insulation is supported by 50 years of research. The weight of that evidence from exposure studies, worker studies, and animal research has not shown an association between exposure to fiberglass and disease in people. Furthermore, I'd point out again that the government has addressed this concern when they announced the listing by the National Toxicology Program, when they said very clearly that a listing of a substance in this report does not establish that any such substance presents a risk to people in their daily lives, and that the listing merely serves as an indicator for the need for additional study.
But why, after 50 years of research, are there still questions about fiberglass? The problem is that the evidence is often conflicting. A group called Victims of Fiberglass, which is partially funded by the cellulose industry, cites a long list of people they say suffer ailments from fiberglass. And as reported in This Old House magazine, some research has shown lung cancer rates for fiberglass workers 16% to 50% higher than the national average. But the fiberglass industry has come to different conclusions.
The weight of the evidence, again, from studies involving exposure, worker health studies, and animal research has demonstrated time and time again the safety of our product. So we do not agree with the conclusion of the review that NRDC cites in their report, nor do a number of others, I should point out, that have also reviewed the health and safety literature on fiberglass.
NRDC says loose fiberglass, the kind sprayed in many attics, is the most dangerous because it is not contained the way fiberglass in rolls or bats is. Anjanette DiCarlo from NRDC says installers face the greatest risk because the protective gear they wear is insufficient.
With fiberglass insulation, considering the possible carcinogenicity or the anticipated carcinogenicity, these are technical terms, people who are installing loose-fill fiberglass should be protected with respirators.
DiCarlo says she doesn't want to alarm people who have fiberglass in their homes. She says once it's in the walls, it's safe, although there are claims that fiberglass can spread through heating and air conditioning systems. As far as insulating value or R-value is concerned, all three of the insulators NRDC looked at, cellulose, cotton, and fiberglass, are for the most part comparable. Several major research projects are underway, and within the next few years, we should know the safety status of fiberglass. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
The population of the U.S. is shifting towards areas which offer access to spectacular wilderness areas. Cities like Boulder, Colorado, and Portland, Oregon are growing quickly, while areas in the nation's heartland are losing population. And that suits Gene Logsdon, author of Contrary Farmer, just fine. He lives on a small farm in rural Ohio and says he finds the world in an area many people pass off as boring. His most recent work appears in a new book, The Earth at Our Doorstep.
My home ground appears to urban America as a dull, plain landscape inhabited by dull, plain people, which is precisely why my wife and I moved here 20 years ago. There are fewer than 24,000 people in our whole county, fewer than there were 100 years ago. There is nothing here that would tempt rapid economic development, nothing to attract the tourists to violate our privacy, nothing to charm the media into turning us into lies. No breathtaking views of either mountain or valley lure the vacationer. No large body of water puts property taxes at the mercy of rich people's condos and vacation homes. The landscape appears to be wall-to-wall corn, bounded by thistles and poison ivy. We are saved from exploitation by an accident of geography. But beneath the cornfields lies a great treasure. This landscape contains some of the planet's richest soils and the best climate to take advantage of them. This land is capable of supporting as many species of plants and animals as any temperate wilderness. I have a hunch it could be transformed into a paradise of flora and fauna as varied as that of the tropical rainforest. That capability lies hidden from social view only by the tall corn's economic stranglehold on the farmer's mind. As I work to bring the soil back to its original fertility, improve the quality of the runoff water, manage the woodland so as to provide the most kinds of wildlife habitat, add more plant species, fill the new pond with fish and amphibians, renew meadow and wetland, the diversity increases. How much it can increase, no one knows. If millions more humans join those of us already in this task, we can change the countryside and even most parts of the city side into a patchwork quilt of pleasant garden farms. These garden farms could support a stable, sustainable society full of natural and domestic wonder, peace and plenty. That is my life's work. I find on my garden farm all the beauty, wonder, challenge, and satisfaction that any human could realistically ask for. I am fulfilled. I have no desire to go anywhere else or do anything else because in traveling my farm, I travel the whole world. And in doing my work, I do the whole world's work.
Gene Loxton is author of The Country Farmer, and his most recent work appears in a new book, The Earth at Our Doorstep. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. The corn and soybean harvest is beginning in the Midwestern United States. Farmers are gearing up for the season. It's harvest time in the Corn Belt, which spreads over southern Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Jim Nichols is a fourth-generation corn and soybean farmer in Minnesota. He says that due to the late wet spring this year, the harvest has been delayed. Nichols gives us some insight on what that means for his crop.
We kind of live and die by the seasons and the frost. Now, one of the things that always happens, and we watch this very closely as farmers, and that's the full moon. Because on the full moon, the sky always clears off. The moon controls the clouds just like it controls the tides. And cloud cover, of course, keeps the warm air close to the ground. When the skies are clear at night, we don't like it as well, because then the warm air from the ground can go as high as it wants. It doesn't stop. And we get a killing frost.
On Nichols' 520-acre farm, harvest starts now and lasts for about 4 to 6 weeks. Once he's finished, he'll till the soil, leaving much on top to stop erosion. He'll be done by Thanksgiving when the ground freezes. This means October and November will be very busy months. Workdays are long and last from sunrise until midnight. But the first step, he says, is to get his combine ready, a machine that heads, threshes, and cleans grain while moving over the field.
For the corn, for example, there are long, thin snouts that stick out between the rows, and the ears of corn are snapped off the plant itself, and you run the ear through the combine, and it shells the kernels of corn off the ear and throws the cobs out the back. For soybeans, you cut the soybeans off right flush with the ground, you run the whole plant through, and you separate the seeds from the plant.
Farming has changed since the days when corn was picked by hand and horses were the machines. Horses are long gone from Nichols' farm. He uses computer technology, commodity markets, and worldwide weather watch to make his crop. He rotates his corn with soybeans to retain soil fertility. Despite all of this, he says the sun and the moon and the rain bind him to his land and his forefathers who worked it before him. Throughout the year, crops are collected from our good land. In a continuing series on the American harvest, we'll be meeting the folks that feed us. In an increasingly urbanized world, let's not forget that before food reaches the supermarket, people and forces of nature produced it. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berling. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262. Ask for show number 352. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is the producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries and ocean science issues, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.